lamp attached to the bottom of the overhang. The warm wind swirled, and I saw a fish lit up and swimming out toward darker water, a bright star hanging far above it. In that moment, I saw, sensed, really, a cord strung between the fish and the star, connecting them. It was silvery and strong, like a rope, distinct, obvious, as if it were really there. There was no unimportant, no negligible being I felt just then. Something as small and seemingly insignificant as one fish in the slapping ocean was connected to the galactic immensity. I told Lorena and my father about the fish and the star soon after we returned to Palo Alto. We were sitting in the car, in the parking lot of the Tower Records in Redwood City, where we'd come to buy CDs. My father turned off the engine. My brother was asleep in the car seat beside me. To my surprise, they remained in the front seat and let me finish the story, speaking from the back seat. Usually they were in a rush. They sat very still, facing the windshield, listening. If I hoped Lorene would save me, I also wanted to save her and imagine myself as her savior, powerful and generous. One day she had turned to me in the kitchen and said, "I was too young." "For what?" "Marriage," she'd said dryly. She'd harvested cauliflower from the garden and put it to steam in the new Elise pot my father had recently brought home, about which he'd been excited, showing us that it rounded out at the sides instead of being straight. A cauldron-shaped pot that was made of the same materials at the same price point as an ordinary pot. But you could see the impact of a better design. "It's so simple and so beautiful," he said, turning it under the kitchen lights. Lorene had gone upstairs and forgotten about the cauliflower, and the water at the bottom had boiled dry and ruined the pan. The idea of getting another one didn't occur to me, and I had no idea where he'd bought it or even how much pans cost. And anyway, we didn't have time to buy another before he got home. The kitchen was filled with smoke. "Oh, shoot, shoot," she said, opening all the windows and the door and fanning furiously with a newspaper. I'd never seen her panic before. She was usually calm. I helped her fan. The house smelled like sugar and carbon and burnt metal. We both fanned furiously. He sometimes pointed out she came from New Jersey and had wide feet, and how she liked the wrong kind of trees. The cauldron pot might symbolize a whole realm of aesthetics he felt she didn't have. "She doesn't have taste," he'd said to dinner guests after she left the room. When he saw the burnt pot, he might be unkind to her for it, as if here was further evidence that she would lay ruin to his refinement. She could do better than him, I thought. I would rescue her. We could rescue each other, drive off in her white BMW like in Thelma and Louise. I was overcome with affection for her. How in spite of it all, she kept being positive, kept working hard to make her company succeed. She understood that life took a certain relentlessness. She continued despite his disapproval, and this forward motion was a model for me. If she was hesitant to leave because she thought no one else noticed, or she doubted her own perceptions, I noticed. I saw. I wanted her to have fulfillment and joy. I believed in her capacities, and I thought that my confidence and my encouragement might be just what she needed to escape. Afterward, the close feeling between us did not remain. It surprised me, each time we were close, that it did not stay. It snapped back and became more formal. My father, displeased about the burnt pot, was taciturn for days. I was still seeing the same therapist, Dr. Lake. I'd been seeing him once a week since I was 9, my father paying for the weekly sessions. His office was a room on Welch Road near the Stanford Hospital. He was tall, with dark hair and a kindly face. When I'd first started coming to him, he'd let me paint a doll with nail polish and ruin it, not complaining when I gave her a short skirt, scissored her hair into a frizzy zag. Now I sat on a daybed against a wall, and he sat in an Eames chair facing me. Sometimes we played checkers or chess. He had a jar of Oreo cookies. Part of the reason I'd agreed to keep seeing him years before was the accessibility of these cookies, which I was allowed to eat at will. Before he worked on Welch Road, when he worked at a different office, we would sometimes walk to the Foster's Freeze down the road, talking as we walked. Now we sometimes walk to the Häagen-Dazs in the Stanford barn where he bought us ice cream. Freud would roll in his grave, he joked. After asking for several months, I finally persuaded my father and Lorene to come along with me for a session. I had a crazy idea that Dr. Lake would say something to them, or he would be silent when they said something, and they would just get it. Then they'd agreed to all my reasonable, I thought, ideas, like getting a couch, saying goodnight, and heat. His presence would make them unable to deny how reasonable I was. My father and Lorene had dressed for the occasion. How coupled and taut they looked, walking in. She smelling of soap and pressed linen, wearing a crisp white shirt and the small gold-rimmed glasses my father had bought for her. My father had put on a new black shirt and jeans without holes. It looked as if he'd just gotten a haircut. Dr. Lake had arranged four wooden chairs with black foam-covered arms around a wooden desk. They sat down, back straight. I had long since abandoned formality around Dr. Lake, and I hoped they would find him comforting too, with his teddy bear nature, his corduroy trousers, his messy but thoughtfully designed office.
"We're here to talk about Lisa," Dr. Lake said.
Silence. I knew Dr. Lake was good at allowing long silences, and sometimes, in order to get him to speak, I would have to let time pass. An uncomfortable pause beyond what seemed reasonable. I cleared my throat. "I've been feeling so lonely," I said. "I was hoping that you could, that we could figure something out." I paused and looked at Lorene, who held her face very still, as if it was a representation of her face and not her real face. "I'm feeling terribly alone," I tried again. Still, they didn't speak. I looked at Dr. Lake. He didn't speak either. We waited. I wished that I wanted less, needed less, was one of those succulents that have a tangle of wiry, dry roots and a minty congregation of leaves and can survive on only the smallest bit of moisture and air. After what seemed an interminable silence, I burst into tears. I hoped it would soften them. That my messiness would give them permission to be messy. I wasn't perfect or straight-backed or smooth. I didn't require them to be so either. Lorene finally spoke.
"We're just cold people," she said.
She said it dryly, like a clarification. "You're allowed to say that?" I thought. How incredible. That's what struck me later, that she had dared to say it. How good it would be to know one's limitations and say them with an unapologetic conviction. Her tone was deadpan. I had thought I could shame them for being cold and absent. Now I was the one who was ashamed, for ignoring the simple truth. How obvious it was. They were just cold people. The clarity of the pronouncement stopped my tears. I looked to my father, who did not speak. He isn't cold, I thought. He just withholds his affection in a pattern I can't predict or control. In the end, maybe it added up to the same thing. Our time was up. We filed out of the office together. Dr. Lake surprising himself, he told me later, by what he said to them in the hallway between the office and the waiting room as they walked out.
"You were just as I expected you to be."
"You've got to trust in your life," my father said, coming into my room that night as I sat at my desk, copying notes in small handwriting on small note cards for memorization. "If you trust your intuition and listen to it, it will speak louder. Ever heard of the concept, be here now?" What did it mean? Something about existing in the moment. But I had homework to do. I found most of the work boring,
motivating myself with the idea of Harvard. To be here now is to be miserable.
Lise, he said.
What?
You should smoke some pot, he said.
I was too serious, was the implication. But I didn't trust him. I was a junior. Grades mattered.
I'll do it with you, he said, if you want.
No thanks, I said. He'd make me lose my motivation in a stupor of weed, or so I imagined. Then he could say, see, she wasn't worth it.
You'll be a hippie someday, he said. Trust me.
No, I won't, I said. I knew he meant the word as some kind of shorthand for peace and relaxation. But I'd known hippies before I'd known him. Men who wore brown and let their hair grow. The memory left a dusty taste in my mouth.
Suit yourself, he said,
and walked out of my room, springing on the heels of his Birkenstocks, whistling, as if to parade his own peace and happiness before me. Later that night, I dreamt that a classmate I hardly knew named Josh and I hovered side by side above the hills that wrinkled up west of the town. Josh and I were in the same English class and also on the staff of the school newspaper, but we'd hardly ever talked. In the dream, we were wearing special backpacks that allowed us to float. We bobbed in the air, lazily, looking towards San Francisco in the distance. The spikes and glints of high buildings and Victorian houses and slanting pastel arcs, and beyond them, the bright, friendly Pacific Ocean lapping against the shore. The city was more vivid than in life, both far away and near, the perspective foreshortened, the way certain atmospheric conditions will make distant things appear alternately far away and very close. In the dream, I looked at Josh, joy welling up like a balloon rising from my chest into my throat. I was so excited I had to be careful to say the word slowly, to not let them rip out.
Let's go, I said.
We bobbed slowly forward toward the great metropolis, the most thrilling city I knew. The next morning in class, I leaned over my desk and tapped him on the shoulder before Mrs. Pa arrived. Hey, I had a dream about you last night. He turned around to face me.
Uh-oh, he said, smiling. What was it about?
We flew to San Francisco. Floated, actually. I mean, we had these flotational backpacks.
Well, we should do it then, he said. We should...
But then Mrs. Paul arrived, and Josh turned to face the front, and class began. At my mother's house, I was vaguely aware that at some point, maybe when I left for college, the child support checks from Jeff Hausen would stop arriving. My mother had no other reliable source of income. She must have been aware of this too, and also wanted to be independent of my father. She approached each new money-making idea with fervor and optimism. She admired Mrs. Fields, who made the chocolate chip cookies, and Nancy of Nancy's Quiche, women who'd made a fortune in business. But what she failed to account for is that it wasn't just the quality of the product that turned ideas into money, but business savvy, marketing and strategy know-how. Once my mother planned to have a garage sale, but until the day before, she didn't put up any signs. We had nice things to sell, nicer things than in most garage sales, but few people knew about it. Almost no one came. She was likewise not methodical about selling her art. When her stencils didn't sell at Neiman Marcus or Smith & Hawken or get snapped up via word of mouth, she was discouraged and put her hope in a new project. Floor cloths, paintings that went on the floor. They were colorful acrylic squares and rectangles of unmounted canvas. Deep plum and rich orange and all different shades of green. Ripe fruits, blossoms, and leaves and patterns, some stenciled, some painted, lacquered with expensive jolly glaze she poured over the paint to protect it that cracked pleasingly, like the surface of old porcelain. She and her friend were both working on them, but her friend had no artistic training. Hers were far better. Canvases were strung up along the walls of her studio in various states of completion, along with used stencil patterns hanging up to dry. I liked sitting in the garage with her as she painted. She seemed to forget about me and dissolved into a deeper part of herself. When she tapped the stencil brush up and down, it sounded like a faraway woodpecker. I picked at the splotches on the board she used as a palette. Indigo, carmine, white, gamboge, which seemed to be a dull, pasty brown, but when mixed with water became electric yellow, the color of a mosquito wine. The top layer of the glob of paint was hard, but if I pressed, wet paint inside came oozing out. To clean the paint brushes, she knocked them against the inside walls of the metal jar of turpentine. When we heard my father call out, we left the garage and went to find him in the house. He hadn't come over for years. I wasn't sure why he'd come this day. He stood in the middle of the kitchen, too straight, wearing a gray sweatshirt with a hood threaded with a red cord that hung on either side of the neck. He looked around as if mildly disappointed. "Steve," she said, "how are you doing?" "Great," he said. "What are you working on?" He moved his shoulder and scapula like he was carving a semicircle in the air. "Floor cloths," she said. "What's that?" he asked. "They're paintings, but underfoot," she said, towing a pomegranate painted on a piece of canvas under the sink. "They're mats, really, for in the kitchen or wherever, but they've got a protective coating. Anyway, I'm doing them with a friend, and we think there's definitely a market. We might sell them at Macy's or Neiman Marcus." I knew she wanted his approval and recognition. We both wanted it. He knew about business. He knew about money in the world. He was a success. She became voluble but also unsure, especially when he was about to be unkind, as if she knew he was going to be cruel and knew how to smoke out the meanness first. I watched them take their places as if in a familiar choreography. She had said she wanted to be free of him, and he had said he wanted to be free of her. But yet, after all these years, they were still entangled. They would thrash around in a single net, becoming more stuck. "I'm also doing stencils," she said. "Show me," he said. She took him through the screen door under the purple blossoms and the greedy whine of bees into the cool studio. I followed them. He looked around, putting his face up close to each painting, saying nothing, as if he knew what to look for. We hung back near the door where it was still warm, waiting for a verdict. "You know, Chris," he finally said in a friendly tone, "you might as well just have some more kids." As he left the garage, he seemed lighter, looser. He waved, walked to his car, and drove away. My mother and I stood in shock at the back of the driveway. When I went back to my father's house, Mona arrived for a visit with her husband Richie for a weekend. My father had a cold. He was in a dark mood. I avoided him, slipping out of rooms when he entered them, trying to stick near Mona and Richie, who were funny and warm, and feeling panicked when they went for a walk and left me alone in the house with him. At some point, I was hungry and went into the kitchen and found him there standing at the counter, eating from a bag of almonds. "How's homework going?" he asked. I could tell he was preoccupied with something, worried. "Fine," I said, bracing. "The thing is, Lise," he said, in the slow voice that meant he was about to say something incisive and possibly devastating, "you have no marketable skills. Not one." He popped another almond into his mouth. The subject seemed to come from nowhere. Why were we talking about marketable skills mid-morning on a Saturday? "But I'm doing all these activities," I said, "and I get A's." And yet, even as I said it, the newspaper, mock trial, the fact that I'd worked at a lab over the summer and took Japanese, I wilted. I got his point. The confection of extracurricular activities, the flurry of self-importance, it was just a fever dream. No one hires someone for being on a debate team. I had not impressed him or fooled him. He knew all this stuff wasn't worth much, and he was worried for my future. I assumed that activities led to other activities in a ladder ascending to adult responsibility. I wasn't supposed to be prepared for an adult job. Others seemed to think that too. At the same time, because he spoke with authority, and because I had been hoping to impress him, and because he was famous and successful and knew about the world, the remark was devastating.
I wouldn't lose sleep over it, Mona said. He's just being silly.
I wanted her to say he was totally insane, to make him recant, in part because I worried he was right, if not about now, then about later, that I'd never be a success, never be able to get a job. We all made allowances for his eccentricities, the ways he attacked other people, because he was also brilliant, and sometimes kind and insightful. Now I felt he'd crush me if I let him. He would tell me how little I meant over and over until I believed it. What use was his genius to me? I was weary of going back and forth between my parents' houses. I decided to split the remaining time before college in half, 6 months with each. I knew my father would not like the idea. The truth is, I would have moved back into my mother's house, but I worried this would make him furious, and I didn't want to leave Reed. I'd figured out that to negotiate effectively, you must be willing to give up the thing you want entirely for something else. You need a fierce apathy. Since he'd said I had no marketable skills, something had shifted and loosened inside me. Things were not going to work out with him the way I'd hoped when I'd moved in. I waited for him to walk into the hallway after lunch that weekend, sitting on the side of the door. Can I talk to you for a minute? Yep, he said and sat beside me on the dark wooden bench. I'm sure you know how difficult it is for me to go back and forth, I said. The two houses are polar opposites. I like to split the year. I was shaking. The trick was to make the request before revealing the underbelly, the girders and joists, the pylons. But you're already at 2 months, he said. In fact, I'd like you to start coming more frequently. I don't like the way you've been doing this. If you want to be part of this family, you're going to have to be here more. You know what? Nope, he said. It's not all right. Other people sought resolution, but he could sustain a dissonant note. He got up and started to walk away. If you won't let me split it, I said as if in passing, I'm going to go to my mom's house for the whole year. I watched him from the corner of my eye. He seemed to deflate all at once. I'd never negotiated with him and won. He turned back. Well, okay. Fine. The winning felt uncomfortable, as though I'd wounded him. I felt an obligation to be merciful. Let me know which half you'd like, I said. I'll think about it, he said, walking away. I'd won. It wasn't much. It was a step. I would get away. I would work toward freedom. One day, I would dangle my limbs from a car window beneath high arching branches. Flight. In my senior year at Pali, I was elected to the position of editor-in-chief of the paper. Now it would be me and three others who would edit the pages and finally deliver the paper to the press late at night. The editors-in-chief from previous years had seemed to me impossibly mature and knowledgeable. Now we would be the ones to look that way to others. That year, we published articles about how the school board, amid massive layoffs, had given credit cards to staff members who treated themselves to, among other things, an expensive lunch at MacArthur Park. After the series of articles came out, the head of the school board resigned. In the middle of 1 week, there were technical problems. The computer system crashed, the screens went dark, the printer became inaccessible. If the computers no longer operated and would not reboot, days of work would be lost. All of our carefully designed pages. Josh, His dirty blonde hair, the color of a sand dune, worn in a thick ponytail, lay down on the floor to inspect and arrange the wires. The rest of us mulled in a daze of terror and tragedy. He always managed to fix it. The computers would sputter back to life, and the printer would aspirate and spit paper again. "Do you want to come?" he asked me, about a trip to his house to get a missing cord. I noticed Josh more closely. Dimples when he smiled, wide shoulders beneath flannel shirts. He was shy and friendly, and had loose, complicated handwriting, like the bouncing string of a kite. "Sure," I said, not knowing then that he lived in Portola Valley, 20 minutes away. His mother and stepfather were lawyers, and had managed to get him permission to transfer to Palo Alto School District based on some provision about their commute to work. He seemed to me sloppy. Too relaxed. Shambolic. He could fix computers, but he was disorganized, forgetting to do his assignments for Mrs. Paw's English class, whereas I was meticulous, a grade grubber. He never arrived anywhere on time, and he was hopeless with a calendar, wouldn't have his homework, and scrambled to do it in the minutes before class. Later, I would find out that he was taking applied mathematics and differential equations at Stanford, and he would be admitted to college at Stanford and MIT. He drove a used 83 Toyota Supra, an incandescent teal, with a pink sine wave painted along both sides. "Sorry about the paint job," he said as we got in. He'd bought it used from a female physicist in Livermore. He had nice hands on the steering wheel. His room had a mattress on the floor and a window looking out to a yard and the forest. There were papers and books strewn around, a stack of stereo equipment and headphones. It was large enough to seem empty and cluttered at the same time. He found the cord and we left. On the way back, we turned onto Arrastradero, a two-lane road, rough and patched, that wound beside a nature preserve. "I'm going to show you a secret," he said. "Hang on." The speed limit was 25. He began to accelerate. We advanced toward a blind corner where the road rose up and then disappeared, a hill on one side, a drop on the other. The road curled back on itself, around the hill, out of sight. Another car might be advancing toward us and smash into us at the bend. A family of deer might be walking across. He continued to build speed, shifting up. Third, fourth, fifth. The car rumbled and whined.
"Are you sure you should be..."
"Don't worry," he yelled. "I've done it before." My mother sometimes said, there are guardian angels just for teenagers. Oh, help me, God of teenagers, I thought. Oh, God of teenagers.
"Hold on," he yelled.
The car scraped. The gears sang. I gripped the top of the seatbelt in one hand, the door handle in the other. He shifted again, peeled around the blind curve, and then we flew. It was because of the uneven road, a raised portion followed by a long dip downhill. If you got up enough speed, you could catch the lip of the up and fly over the concavity, through the dots of light cast by the row of emerald trees and bushes growing alongside the road. For me, the flight unlitted the town. There were hidden places of freedom, and he knew them. After we delivered the third paper a few months later, the other editors-in-chief, Rebecca, Nicole, Tom, and I stood together near Nicole's car in the school parking lot in the late afternoon. Most of the other cars were gone, and copper light slanted through pine trees in between the parking spaces. In the distance, I saw a couple approaching, holding hands. It was Josh, wearing a too big white shirt and trousers that looked like Harlequin pants. I found out later he'd made them himself with scraps of cloth, first mixing up the waist and the ankles and then starting again. He strolled toward us, his legs wide and bending at impact with the ground. I didn't know the girl. She was pretty and thin, with wavy, honey-colored hair. They unclasped hands as they got closer.
"Hey, Josh," Tom said. "We just delivered the paper."
I felt my face muscles go slack. I had pitied him before, thinking him undesirable. Now that he was with another girl, I felt shy and embarrassed and small, standing there near the two of them. I biked home and cried to Carmen, who ran her fingers through my hair. An hour later, someone clanked open the gate. I looked over the rose bushes. Josh had never come over before, but we had friends in common, so he knew where I lived. He had a bounce in his step as he walked to the door, the white linen shirt swaying over the patchwork pants. I invited him in and he followed me to my room. The whole thing was strange, how I hoped fervently that he'd come over, even if he'd never done so before, and now he was here. "What's up?" I said, standing in the middle of the room under the box-shaped lantern.
"I thought you seemed upset just now."
He stood nearby, his legs apart, his chest high. "You were with that other girl," I said.
"She's older," he said. "She goes to Stanford."
"It's just... I didn't realize that I liked you. And now it's too late.
We're just friends. I don't know her that well. Anyway, the truth is..."
"What?" I asked.
"I've had a crush on you since freshman year. Since Living Skills," he said.
We had been partners during the section on CPR, although I had forgotten. How was it possible that someone had liked me during those years, when I was new to the school and to my father's house and didn't have any friends? He leaned toward me on one foot and we kissed. Everything was perfect and fluttered open.
"Bye," he said after that and smiled.
He walked out, his linen shirt rippling behind him, and I ran to the kitchen to tell Carmen.
"What are you going to be when you grow up?"
my father asked Josh when they met. We were sitting with him on the floor in my brother's room, near the bookshelf, the first time I'd been alone with the two of them.
"I don't know yet," Josh said.
"I know," my father said.
"You're going to be a bum."
Josh looked down. When I told my mother, she reminded me my father had called himself a bum in high school when she introduced him to her father, and that he sometimes used his own stories as templates for his idea of perfection. It was a compliment, even though it didn't seem so. Sometimes after dark, Josh and I would drive to the Woodside house to make out. There were no lights, but you could see the white house, the white mist and silver dew on the lawn sloping down toward the significant trees. He said he was going to build a slide from there to there, into the pool, I said, pointing up. But he never did. The bedroom and the bed were still the same as when I'd stayed with my father on Wednesday nights. The mattress was still on the floor beside the television. On a dresser was a framed picture of my father and Tina at a party, her wearing a black dress. When he talked about Tina, he said wistfully that she never wore dresses, but there she was. His suits were gone from the closet. "Follow me," I said. I took off my shoes and ran through the wet lawn and whooped down the slope toward the oak trees. There was no one around. It smelled of cardamom pods, eucalyptus buttons, pepper, water, and bark. The sky was low and heavy with stars. Some stars were dim and fuzzy, and others were pointed and bright. They were messy and close. The sky demanded notice.
"He bought the house for the trees," I said slowly in a British accent like Laurence Olivier.
"I would have bought it for the house," Josh said.
Looking back, it was all white arches covered in moonlight, white as salt. It gave me a shiver the way it looked stark and alone. "Me too," I said. "But he says the house is shit." The trampoline was covered in leaves from the oak trees. We climbed on and jumped. There was no wall or guard around it. We hit each other in midair.
"What's over there?"
It was a smaller house on the property, also his. Empty. From up here, you could see its white outline, and past that, hills.
7 acres, I said in the British accent.
If we didn't go to the Woodside house,
Josh would drive over to the Waverly house at night, careful not to clink the ring on the gate. He would creep through the rose garden and climb through my window into my bed, his hands ice cold because he drove with all the windows down. He would stay with me until early morning, then sneak out again through the window or the sliding glass door, and drive home again.
What if we found out Josh was coming over every night? My father asked at breakfast, sneaking through the window.
I gulped. Didn't say anything, and he didn't mention it again. I managed to convince myself he might not know.
Are you and Josh going to the Woodside house to make out?
He asked me a few days later. Josh and I had been discovered by a gardener they'd recently hired from Australia. He was staying in the house unbeknownst to me, and who'd followed the sound of music and found us one night in an empty room on the second floor. No one had mentioned the gardener was staying there. I thought of lying, or saying we'd been there only once, but the freedom I'd have if he said okay seemed worth the risk.
Yes, I said. Are you okay with that?
I guess so, he said.
It happened, I said. We sat side by side on the edge of my bed. The final base. I was 17, a senior.
Was it all right? He asked.
It was. I did not tell my father that at first the angle was wrong, and so for a little while we thought sex would not be possible for us, that we were built incompatibly, that the parts did not fit the way they should. Sometimes, in the late afternoon after school during the weeks when we were not producing the newspaper, Josh and I went to Windy Hill Preserve, up above skyline, hills wide and yellow and soft like the humps of camels. On one side, more hills like a blanket thrown out into the wind all the way to the Pacific Ocean. The town was a miniature below us, silent and still except for the singing, rasping wind that flattened the tall grasses. A clear day, too much to take in, the glassy air, and the feeling of great freedom and grace, the world opening. I looked north, and I could see San Francisco sparkling in the distance, but clear like it was close. It was like the way I'd seen it in the hovering dream, both close and far away. Something to do with the angle from this hill to those hills, the refraction of the light. That's how I felt about my parents now that Josh was around. Not that I didn't worry about how my mom would earn money, or about my father mocking me, or even what would happen when he realized that I was really leaving for college. I was simply hovering above it all, so it didn't pinch or press. Now Josh was the one who drove me to doctor's appointments or between houses. He did not keep a calendar, forgot about homework assignments, and missed dentist appointments and other appointments, but never the ones with me. I was protected inside his teal Supra. After the spring rains, when the grasses came up out of the clods of dirt under the oak and eucalyptus trees around Stanford, viridian fuzz like whiskers, stripes of gold light and long bright ribbons, I thought, this is my town. I walked home after school and noticed the seasons change. Before this, it was my father's town, or my mother's town, or the town where I'd been placed by accident and shifted around. Now, I was in love, and the land was dimensional and heavy and particulate. It belonged to me. During lunchtime, I visited Pally's college admissions office, presided over by a woman with short gray hair named Mrs. Doss. I flipped through a binder to find the names and addresses of students who'd been accepted to Harvard. Harvard. Monstrous, distant, and separate from me, pulling away. It was the most legitimate organization I could think of. Also, it was one decision that seemed to eradicate uncertainty. Once I'd chosen it, I didn't have to make other decisions or discoveries. It seemed right. Not for me, necessarily, as I didn't know what would be right for me at all, and hadn't bothered to think that far, but right in a general sense. There were usually a few acceptances per year.
There was a space for the students to list where their parents had gone to college, and I read through all of them, trying to find an instance in which a parent had not been to college. I paid for an SAT class, biking there on Saturday mornings. I didn't tell my parents about the process, although they knew I was applying to college. They didn't seem to understand the steps involved or ask me questions about it. I applied for early admission. Along with the application, we were asked to enclose a self-addressed, stamped postcard. I snuck into Lorene's office and took a fetching postcard from her book of Cartier-Bresson's black and white photographs. I liked these postcards. I wanted Harvard to find my application tasteful. The postcard I'd stolen would arrive back at the house, making my theft obvious. But I cared more about making an impression than I did about getting caught. My father was away on a business trip, so I faked his signature on the application. Over a long weekend, I flew to New York to stay with Mona and look at colleges. My mother couldn't afford to take me. My father didn't have time. Mona knew more about colleges anyway. She lived on the Upper West Side in an apartment with a line of round windows surrounded by stripped wood that looked out over Riverside Park. The radiators clanked. Mona took me to walk around Columbia University, where she'd gone to graduate school. She took me to see Princeton, which she favored for me, and then Harvard, where I'd arranged to have an interview at the admissions office instead of with an alumnus in California, because I thought it would increase my chances of admission to be close to the source. Two men I knew who'd been to Harvard warned me off. Dr. Botstein at the Stanford Genetics Lab, where I'd worked for 2 summers, said he'd been unable to join the finals clubs because he was Jewish. "I'm not going to tell you not to go," he said, "but I would give it a lot of thought." I wasn't able to believe in the possibility of my own acceptance then, let alone turning it down. The other man, Dr. Lake, said that he had been lonely there and it felt institutional, and that it wasn't until he got to medical school at the University of Chicago that he'd felt happy. I didn't believe either of them. They'd gone a long time ago. I knew what was best for me, I thought, even though I knew almost nothing about Harvard. It wasn't happiness I was after, but something they might not understand. A seal of approval and escape. Harvard, I thought, would make me worthy of something, of existence. I didn't think anyone could comprehend how much I wanted to go to this place I knew so little about. It was autumn. Clear and stinging cold outside when Mona and I visited. No more beautiful or cold than Princeton or Columbia had been. The idea of it, the glamour and luck I associated with it, the brand, hovered beside the fact of it, gave it luster and dignity. The buildings, lawns, and trees. The waiting room of the admissions office was overheated and smelled of paint, with cream-colored walls and blue carpet. Other prospective students sat in chairs nearby. I wore a black skirt with black tights. I was nervous. It was true that I had not received a single B during high school, but I'd had to work hard for the grades. My SAT scores were good, but not stratospheric. This interview could make a difference. "Lisa?" I stood when I heard my name. A tall woman with dark hair, wearing a skirt and a white sweater, said, "Follow me," and led me down a hallway and into a small, dim room. She seemed bored. She did not seem charmed by me, but almost annoyed by my presence. "Why don't you tell me a bit about your interests outside of school?" the woman said. She made no reference to my application, as if she hadn't read it. "Let's see," I said. "I suppose I do many things, like most of your candidates." I wanted her to understand that I knew I was human despite my great accomplishments, and humble, aware of, and even embarrassed by the excess of extracurricular activities I had collected for the purpose of saying them at this very moment. "I'm an attorney on our mock trial team, and I'm editor-in-chief of the school newspaper, with a staff of 80, I said, glossing over the fact of the other 3 editors-in-chief. "I also take advanced Japanese, after having gone to Japan with my school, and later with my father on a business trip." He also helped me get a job at a lab at Stanford, where I developed photographs of yeast cells under the electron microscope and conducted large-scale experiments on yeast, inserting vectors of DNA into the cells. As if I were in charge of the experiments, when I only followed instructions. As if I were passionate about any of these activities besides the newspaper, or cared about Japanese or yeast as anything but a way to get into this place. If admitted, I would drop them. I sat in my chair, my legs crossed. I slipped my father into the conversation like an accident. I would use him. He was my only advantage after the grades and the activities. "And what does your father do?" she asked politely. I hesitated, lifting my eyebrow as if to say, "Oh, him?" I took a breath to indicate I hadn't expected the conversation to go there. "He started a computer company," I said. "He invented a computer called the Macintosh." I said it as if she might not have heard of it. At that, the woman stood. She looked alarmed. "Excuse me," she said. "I'll be right back." She grasped the doorknob and left the room abruptly, closing the door behind her, as if she'd realized all at once she had to attend to something urgent outside the room. It was too obvious. I wondered if it could possibly be happening like this. Would she rush out and stop them from turning down my application? Were there other admissions officers shifting through the files of those being interviewed at that very moment? A few minutes later, she returned. She didn't explain where she'd been or why she'd dashed out, but seemed kinder and more attentive. She asked me a few more questions I don't remember, and the interview concluded. When I left, my cheeks burned. Back home, as I waited to find out if I got in, I wore corduroy for luck. I wore it top to bottom, corduroy pants with a corduroy shirt. The pants were wide whale moss green. The shirt was a finer whale button-down with pockets, indigo blue. It felt like velvet. Usually I wore these items singly, when I was taking or receiving the grade for an important test. It was production week at the paper, and three of the four editors-in-chief had applied early to Harvard. We promised each other we wouldn't call and find out until the current issue of the paper was finished with production. Harvard had a hotline you could call to find out if you got in or not, Rebecca said, and later in the week she broke the deal, called, discovered she was in, told Nicole, and after that I started calling too, using the phone in the classroom, the line perpetually busy. It was also possible that an acceptance or rejection letter would arrive in the mail one day that week, and so I wore the corduroy not only for the possibility of getting through on the phone, but also as a prophylactic against the chance I'd arrive home to find the letter on the counter when I was not wearing the lucky outfit. As a result, I'd been wearing the same clothes for 4 days straight. On Thursday, I decided I'd call the minute the phone lines opened. I set an alarm for 4:30 a.m. The admissions office call center opened at 7:30 a.m. in Boston. The woman on the other end of the line was distant and professional. She took my last name and put me on hold. "Congratulations," she said when she returned, her voice warm, relieved maybe, as if she too had been frightened of having to say no. It took me a moment to understand what she meant. "Wait," I said. She laughed. "You've been admitted to the Harvard class of 2000. The words were scripted, but they might have been her own words said with such joy. "Thank you," I said. "Oh, thank you." I got out of bed, put on my shoes with my pajamas, grabbed a sweater, and walked out the door into the dawn light, a blue veil over the street. The houses and lawns and cars were lit up, but motionless like a stage set. Nothing stirring but me. Celebration was absorbed like the sound of a footstep on a damp lawn. The neighborhood was quiet, and I would be leaving it. That changed it. Made it seem flat like a drawing. I walked past Kevin and Dorothy's house. Everyone was sleeping. As I walked, a few porch lights went off. They must have been on timers, and sprinklers began to hish, hish, hish. I stepped back into the house and ran to my room and ripped sheets of lined paper out of a notebook. I got in, I wrote. I taped them up on the windows that lined the hallway. After a while, I heard my father and Lorene stirring upstairs. I waited in the hallway, pacing, still in my pajamas. They walked down, first my father, then Lorene. I held my breath.
Oh,
Lorene said.
What is this?
My father said.
Got in where?
Ding dong, Lorene said. She's into Harvard.
Oh, he said.
Right. Soon after, I would be moving to my mother's house. I called out to my brother from the bottom of the stairs. For his 4th birthday, I bought him a royal blue satin cape with silver stars and a ruffle around his neck. It came with a magician's conical hat and a wooden wand.
Reed?
I called out. No response. I thought I heard a light shuffle upstairs.
Glinda?
I called instead. This was one of the names he went by in costume.
Esmeralda? Valencia?
Yes, from a room upstairs came a thin, watery reply.
I'm Valencia.
I found him playing make-believe. I want to talk to you, I said and sat him down beside me on the floor. From now on, I'm going to live mostly with my mother. When I spoke, he was distracted, facing me but looking away. My mother had suggested I tell him in the form of a story. There was once a prince and a frog, I began. I wasn't sure why I'd made myself into the frog. The prince loved the frog, and the frog loved the prince more than any other prince. They were dear friends. But then, one day, the frog had to go back to his own kingdom. He listened now, rapt. Why did he have to go away? Reed asked. There were other frogs, a land of frogs. He'd been away for a long time. But you see, the frog still loved the prince. He wasn't leaving because he didn't. He just had to leave for his own reasons. The story was undeveloped. No real plot, leaden. But he didn't seem to mind and wanted more.
But he had to leave?
Yes, I said. Because he needed to go home to the other frogs. Later that year, my sister Erin was born, after I'd moved to my mother's house. She had dark hair and a widow's peak and large, soulful eyes. If she was still awake when I visited, I would hold her and stroke her forehead up toward her hairline. At just one stroke, she would fall miraculously fast asleep. In the months leading to her birth, my father traveled in Europe for work. His company, Pixar, which was on the verge of going public, and he returned from these trips with baby dresses from expensive shops, so that by the time she was born, she already had many in plum and jute and white, hanging on a rail. Harvard sent a form we were supposed to fill out to determine who our roommates would be. I wanted to sound cool and easygoing in order to attract cool, easygoing roommates. I concluded an autobiographical paragraph with the line, "And occasionally, I like to pick up a guitar and play a song." This did not capture me at all, as uptight as I was. I'd once been able to play a couple of songs, but had since forgotten. And even when I could play, I had been mortified to play in front of other people. The summer before I left for college, when I was living at my mother's house, my father took me to San Francisco to get a coat. It was his idea. And if I'd known he'd get me a coat, I might not have collected the others. We went to Emporio Armani, located in a converted bank with a towering ceiling and a cafe inside an internal balcony. We stopped at a rack of ties my father inspected and held with his thumb and index finger. I liked the way he held things. He looked at them with such intensity, but then he didn't bother to buy any. I worried, as I always did when shopping, that my size would be sold out. On the far wall below the balcony of the cafe were the coats. These were not coats for California, but for another kind of life.
"How about this one?" he said.
Black wool with a collar and a double row of buttons that ran down the front. It swung out at the bottom like a dress. We would have to get it adjusted, the sleeves, the length.
It's nice, he said.
Quite nice, I agreed. But I wondered if it was too unusual, and what others would be wearing when I arrived. It looked like a dress for a French mime. He bought it for me. On the day my father bought me the coat, on the way back to Palo Alto along Highway 101, the coat left with the tailor for alterations. He and I hardly spoke. He didn't joke about rubies when we passed it. It didn't occur to me that he was silent because he was considering the fact that I was leaving, that he might miss me after I'd gone. Or he might have been thinking about work, about Next and Pixar. The silence between us would grow over the next years. Soon he would no longer write or call back. I wasn't sure how it started or why. That day he looked ahead, both hands on the wheel, moving his shoulder in its socket, brushing his thumbs back and forth and clenching his jaw, the rhythms continuous, but not exactly the same, like a mechanical man.
I'm going to teach you to clean a toilet, my mother said at her house a few weeks later.
I'd shown her the coat back from the tailor, and this was her answer to it, which she would give me in preparation for Harvard. I won't be cleaning toilets where I'm going, I said.
Maybe not, she said.
But you will someday. She was right.
Coda.
If you still desire a thing, its time has not yet come. And when you have what you desired, you will have no more desire. Instead, you will have time. Weak desires protect you from disappointment, but nothing keeps you safer than being a visible ruin. Fanny Howe, Indivisible. I arrived at Harvard alone the week before school started to join the first-year outdoor program. It was hot and humid. I waited in the registration line under a white tent. But when I got to the front and said my name, a woman pulled me aside to say my tuition had not been paid. She seemed skeptical of my right to be there. I told her there must be a mistake, but I was embarrassed and felt exceptionally alone. My dorm assignment and registration packet were delayed. I found a payphone and called Jeff Hausen, my father's accountant, who said he would do his best to set it right. The following week, when I returned from camping, my tuition had been paid, and I was given a dorm assignment. In the first 3 months of my freshman year, before my father stopped responding to my calls and emails, I complained to him on the phone about how I couldn't see since I'd arrived in Boston. Everything was flat and close. There were no vistas. My eyes ached. The buildings were smashed up against the sight lines. All I see is the building in front of me everywhere I go.
It's a metaphor for the East Coast mind, he'd said.
When fall arrived, I was cold in my new coat. I'd brought only a few pair of cotton socks. I did not yet understand the importance of wool. I worried about my mother. How would she afford to pay the rent?
I'll figure something out, she said when I asked. You don't need to worry about me. I always make things work.
She would be the one I'd call for hours every night during my first year in college, for her insights and care, when I found a culture far more alien than I had expected, and after I experienced my first heartbreak when Josh and I broke up, for which neither a fancy coat nor a skill at cleaning toilets had prepared me. I was floored by grief. About heartbreak, my parents gave separately the same advice.
You've got to feel all your feelings. That way next time, when you fall in love again, it will be just as meaningful and profound.
The first heartbreak brings up the pain of the past, my father said. The first big loss. Harness it.
If something is really painful, it's the undertow of a big, beautiful wave, my mother said.
Other people said, get over it and go out.
I took only what interested me. A class on anthropology that was held in the back of a wooden building filled with bones. A film and literature class. A class about the laws protecting children. And an art class in which we had to draw one hand with the other. I joined the paper,
the literary magazine, and did community service at a local school. My father came to visit me once that year. Walking behind me up the stairs to my dorm, he'd said, "You need to lose some weight.